Welcome to Destiny. Now here's your host, Cliff Dunning.
In 2005, a writer, philosopher, sage, actually even a shaman, a modern-day shaman, by the name of Daniel Pinchback, wrote a book called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. And the book was hailed as a look at modern society through the eyes of a philosopher and somebody who was tracking the Western civilization and somewhat comparing it to the Maya, who prophesized that a cycle would end in 2012 and another one would begin. If you remember, during that whole 2012 controversy, religious organizations thought it was a doomsday prophecy. A lot of writers felt, because they didn't understand the Mayan calendar or the Mayan system of divination through their calendars, that the calendar wasn't a doomsday prediction. It was just a ending of a cycle and beginning of a new one. So, but what Pinchback does is he looks at modern society through a shamanistic approach. Now, he is well known for taking multiple ayahuasca journeys and ceremonial journeys to see and hear from the various plant medicine elements, be it animal, earth, Gaia, and other forms of communications when you're in that state, to extract data on where we are going. And the book is very focused on the problems with our environment, how we're poisoning our environment, our addiction to technology, the loss of ability to join with nature and to live more harmoniously, the stock market, our desire, especially in the West, where we're a marketing society. Every year we have to, buy a new washer machine. We have to follow what the Joneses are doing, a new car. Very wasteful practice. So I wanted to have Daniel back to kind of give us an update on what he feels has transpired since his book came out, what he feels, if any, prophecy was came to fruition, and what he thinks our future looks like. And this is this is somebody who follows the ancient ways, but from a modern point of view. And Graham Hancock's another one who will do ayahuasca journeys to get a sense of what's going on. He uses it creatively. And I've never been able to get out from him exactly how many ayahuasca visits or ceremonies he's done, but I believe it's at least five or six. But actually, we're going to ask him when he's on the program. And by the way, as a side note, we have the big guns coming up in the fall. It's going to be November. We have Marian Resnick, astronomer at NASA JPL. That's a big one. And then in December, it's Eric Van Dunnigan, Randall Carlson, and we finish the year with our good friend, yes, that is Graham Hancock. He'll close out the year. But, I'll ask Graham, actually, how often he partakes in ayahuasca journeys. The Brits have not been able to leave their country to go to Central or South America, so I think for the last couple of years, he's been relegated to stay home. But like I said, we'll hear more about it. So anyhow, today is Daniel Pinchback, and we're going to hear his point of view. And you'll hear when he's talking that he's very much a shamanistic approach, not paying attention to Gaia, which also translates to not paying attention to our own bodies. A shaman on Earth Ancients today. All right, it's time to check in with Pepper Hernandez. That is Conversations on Cannabis. And this week we're talking about something that is unique to Canada, but we're hoping that it takes on a life here in the United States. And this is small market cannabis growers coming together in what is can be termed a farmer's market to sell their product directly to the public. So, hey, Pepper, how are you? How you doing?
Hi there, Cliff. Thank you.
So talk a little bit about what you discovered. I guess this is happening or becoming a phenomenon in Canada. What's it all about?
It is. Yeah, I've been recently discussing with Canadian farmers what they are using or starting to use there. It's called FarmGate, and it's a program that allows direct cannabis sales. Now, of course, this has to be local and licensed producers, but those people can give direct cannabis sales to their customers. So it's really neat if we think about these roadside stands that you see all over the country in the U.S. Yeah. You know, they sell peaches during the time of the year, or you'll see blueberries or strawberries. It's the same kind of feel and energy that you get from something like that, but it's happening in Canada for cannabis. Mm-hmm. And it's very exciting. This program is going to allow people to get licensed to do that as well, which is just so cool. And I'm really inspired by it. And I hope that more of Canada does that. There's more attention towards it and that we can start doing those kind of things in the U.S. The beautiful thing about this is it gets that patient or that customer or that consumer direct experience with the farmer. And of course, the farmers still have to go through all of the testing and all of the things that make sure that cannabis is safe for the consumer. But that connection is no longer faceless, right? We don't go into the dispensary and have no idea what the story behind the cannabis is. You're right there on their farm. They can set up little, not necessarily shacks, but little stands that consumers can come directly to and talk to the farmers. It's an amazing idea.
Now, what is the reaction of the dispensaries? They're not liking this, I would imagine, but this is more in support of the small farmer, the boutique farmer that maybe grows an acre or two or less of specific cannabis and gets it directly to the public consumer. So this is actually, it's cutting out the middleman, isn't it?
In these particular situations, yes. And we have to remember the dispensaries are there to serve the communities and they have an overhead. So when they're purchasing big, you know, industrial farm cannabis, that's great. That's a wonderful chain, a line, right, for consumer to sale. However, small craft cannabis, boutique farmers who are just growing a small amount or they have a particular genetics or they've been pheno hunting and they have this one particular cultivar that they love to grow, people need to be able to get their hands on that at an affordable price, as well as being able to support the local farmers so they can pay for their own taxes for their land. I mean, it does, like you said, cutting out a middleman in these type of situations.
I like the idea of doing this because I just read the other day that Amazon is throwing heavy money towards legislating United States legalization of cannabis throughout the whole 50 states. And when they do that, that becomes super commercial and the big guys start buying up the little guys. And then you're right. You lose track of where this good cannabis is grown, who the farmers are and so forth and so on. I personally would love to be able to go to a farmer's market and purchase a few buds and get a sense of what's the good stuff over purchasing from Amazon. What do you think of that?
Well, I think everything has its place.
I guess if you don't have farmers markets in your area, I guess that's the only way to get it, right?
Right. So we want to make sure that the medicine gets to all people, but there is a huge difference between industrial cannabis and those regulations and craft farm, small farm, local cannabis. It's just a huge difference. And we've seen this with food. We've seen this across the U.S. for decades of how food nutrient dense food has, you know, really dropped. You test a cucumber that's industrial grade and you test a cucumber from a farm, there's a huge difference there.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, it's just that black and white. But of course, if you're in a food desert, any food is going to be good. So we want to make sure that it gets to everyone and it's available to everyone. But if you are lucky enough to be right in the mecca of cannabis farms and you can support those people, I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, you cut your teeth on Humboldt, which is the epicenter for high quality, sustainable farming. Would you say that organic cannabis is easily accessible, or would you say as a whole, I mean, you're in Oklahoma now, that the tendency is to still do commercial grade and not use all those sensitive organic fertilizers and such?
Well, I think more people are going towards organic. I mean, that's how it started.
Yeah.
And industrial farms, you know, they lack that. But small craft farmers, they understand the importance of sustainability for their crops and their land. They understand live soil. They understand KNF, which is Korean natural farming techniques. They understand all of these things because it's their livelihood, just like many farmers with other crops. So I think really focusing on those kind of organic sustainability, those kind of people who are doing that and supporting them by purchasing from them is helping them to continue to create.
Yeah. And that's going to mean that they're going to have to get a retail license to sell it to the public directly. You go and visit actual farms now. Are they allowed to sell at their locations when they're at harvest time, or if they're already have the curing phase is done and they're ready to package for the dispensaries, can someone go to a farm and buy direct?
Not at this time of our recording, not in the U.S. as of yet. Now, that's why it's so exciting what's happening in Ontario.
Okay.
Because, you know, that is just breaking the mold. But I do have something really exciting to share with you about the Humboldt Harvest, which is something similar to what we're talking about in Ontario, but it is in one central location. You want to hear about it?
Of course. I'm dead silent. I'm waiting for you to give it to me.
I was just going to wait and see if you wanted to hear. Okay.
What was I supposed to say? Yes, Pepper. Give me the meat and potatoes.
Yes. So it's the Humboldt Harvest. It's a wonderful project and a vision that has been created by farmers for social equity, for female farmers, for legacy farmers. And really what's happening here is they're doing a Humboldt Harvest Farmers Market in Humboldt. It's in Eureka, California. It'll be for the next 6 weeks. And it's at 9 o'clock in the morning to 3. It's just right alongside the farmers market. It's a beautiful thing that's happening. There are about upwards of 25 to 35 farms, and they're the small craft farms of Humboldt that are coming in, and they're bringing their cultivars, their strains. There's said to be close to 5,000 or more pounds of flower. So you could come in.
Oh my God.
I know. So you can come in, you can experience, you can smell, you can, you can't sample or taste, obviously, but it's because it's a farmer's market, but you can meet the farmers, understand what's going on, get suggestions from them. And it's just an amazing way to have really clean medicine that can start with the farmer, as well as understanding the whole entire supply chain. So you're giving your money directly to the farmer. You're cutting out all of the side pieces that then costs money, right? So the farmer can get actually the more money per dollar that you're actually being charged for the cannabis versus all of the other side piece that you would, you know, be paying for.
Yeah, and the other thing is you're probably going to get it for a little bit less than what you would pay at a dispensary because you're getting it farm direct, right?
Well, I'm not certain about that. I would imagine it would be.
Yeah.
But if it's the same price or negotiable close to, you know that all that money is actually going to your farmer who needs to save their land and purchase their next year's license and pay taxes and be in the community and support, you know, all these nonprofits of giving cannabis away that to people who chronically need it in our community. Yeah. So if more communities can ask for things like this, or start organizing things like this, I just think we're in a really good direction with cannabis.
I love the idea of farmers markets. I don't know what the legalities are, but it sounds very, very cool. It sounds like in Canada, they've figured it out and they're doing it already. And this test run in Humboldt, I would love if someone was out there to interview the farmers, I would love to hear from them.
Well, we're going to be out there. We're going to have a team out there with the Cannabis Holistic Institute.
Okay.
Filming the whole thing, interviewing everyone. So
let's get one of the farmers. Yeah. Let's get one of the farmers. Let's do a small hello. What do you grow? And what's the public's reaction to your product kind of interview? I'd love to have 5 or 10 minutes to talk with one of those guys.
Absolutely.
Or gals.
Absolutely. So. We'll make sure that we get that going. And then Cliff, the next time I talk to you, I may be up in the East Coast, touring cannabis farms there and going to the Vermont Cannabis Farmers Market.
Very cool. All right. Excellent. As always, for more information on cannabis in general, go to drpepperhernandez.com. She's got articles. She's got videos. She even has courses. You can learn to become a provider of data or a connoisseur.
Cannabis therapy consultant.
There you go. Cannabis therapy consultant. Cool. All right. As always, excellent material. And we'll talk to you next time, Dr. P.
Thanks, Cliff. Have a beautiful day.
About 15 years ago, a seminal book came out that I thought was pretty substantial called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. It was written by Daniel Pinchbeck. It was an interesting look at, it was almost a prophecy book based on the 2012 calendar that the Maya developed. And what Daniel did was fascinating. He actually looked at a number of different types of events, including psychedelics, evolution, and just future-related types of topics. And I wanted to have Daniel come on the program and talk a little bit about what he sees as an evolution from this 2012 book written many years ago. And where we stand as a culture, how he sees where we're going, and some of the interesting topics that he brought up in this wonderful book. If you don't know who Daniel Pinchbeck is, he is the best-selling author of Breaking Open the Head, When Plants Dream. By the way, if you're interested at all in ayahuasca, get When Plants Dream. Graham Hancock thinks it's a marvelous book, and I think he actually wrote a review on it. And also the other book is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, which we're talking about today. His essays and articles have appeared in a vast range of publications, including the New York Times, Esquire, Rolling Stone, and Art Form. So, and Daniel is a prolific writer. If you haven't read his material, I really strongly urge it. So Daniel, welcome to Destiny. How you doing?
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm fine.
Cool. What would you say? I mean, there's so much I want to ask you about regarding stepping forward and looking at the world right now. You brought up a great deal of information, but how influential was the Mayan calendar in this book, 2012?
Well, it was the, you know, kind of the jumping off point. I mean, I wrote a first book called Breaking Open the Head that was about psychedelic shamanism. And when I started that book, I was a kind of scientific materialist, skeptic. I had all sorts of paranormal and psychic experiences in the course of going through different journeys and initiations with the Bwiti tribe in West Africa and Gabon and communities, indigenous communities in Mexico and the Amazon and Ecuador. That ultimately shifted my worldview towards realizing that there are these other levels of the psyche. The consciousness is a much bigger story than we're understanding it. And I realized that these indigenous communities, cultures around the world, had a knowledge of the psyche that modern civilization had forfeited, and that we actually had to take their knowledge systems more seriously. And then I discovered that a lot of different indigenous and ancient cultures around the world looked towards this time as a time of intense transformation and prophetic change. I also discovered the works of Terence McKenna and Jose Arguelles, who were also kind of psychedelically inspired, like thinkers and visionaries, who also kind of prophesied that, you know, based on this ancient understandings, that 2012 was this threshold of transformation. So yeah, the Mayans were very sophisticated. The classical Mayan civilization was very, very profound, sophisticated society, about which we probably still don't understand that much. They you know, really embedded a lot of knowledge about the cosmos in their sculptures and structures. And they had a different understanding of the nature of time than we did, which was embedded in a really complex cylindrical system, which included the Zulkan, a 13 by 20 matrix of 260 days that repeats their sacred calendar, repeats on larger and larger scales. And actually we were ending a cycle of what they call 13 baktuns of over 5,100 years in on December 21st, 2012. And as far as a number of different archaeologists and visionaries could understand it, they were, you know, the indication was that this was the end of a prophetic cycle leading to a new cycle and a transformation of human society, human consciousness, the earth itself.
Right. I see that. I'm a Mayanist myself. It's a ending of one phase, beginning of a new cycle. Why do you think the world was so doom and gloom about it? Why? I mean, the church went nuts on it, and there was article, and I think there even was some movies based on the calendar that were fairly negative. Why do you think that it was?
Well, I mean, in terms of the movies, I mean, Apocalypse sells. And, you know, they're always looking for another reason to make like a global disaster movie. Yeah, it was a really terrible, terrible film. It was made about 2012.
Yeah.
You know, we have a limited, you know, our culture has a very limited frame of reference. And, I mean, you know, ironically, in actual fact, you know, it does look, it seem to be the case that we're in a time of, you know, accelerating destruction. When we look at what's happening ecologically, right, we're seeing mass species extinction, forest fires all over the world, accelerated climate change, the bleaching of the coral reefs, desertification, collapse of the global insect population, et cetera, et cetera. So these all seem very in line with these prophecies from various cultures.
Right. You know, the title is Quetzalcoatl, and Quetzalcoatl is this bringer of reform and change and education. Did you use that as a for your book as a way to begin showing that we need to change who we are? Our environment's going to hell. We're stuck on our iPhones all the time. We just can't break away from the internet. I mean, would you say that you are prophesizing in a way either change or don't? Or don't exist or fail? I mean, our environment's in really bad shape right now.
I'm not quite sure what the question is, but Quetzalcoatl is a Mayan, Mesoamerican creator deity. Actually, the Mayan name is different, Kukulkan. So it represents the feathered serpent, which is the meeting of the bird and the snake, which is also could be seen as the meeting between earth and heaven, spirit and matter. The bird, its feathers representing spirit, the snake representing matter or earth. And so in that way, it's a symbol that represents the paradoxical union of opposites. It represents potentially the kundalini rising from the base of the spine up to the crown chakra. It has a lot of different meanings. You know, as I was writing the book on 2012, you know, Quetzalcoatl kept recurring as a kind of motif, but then I actually had a, transmission experience while doing ayahuasca in Brazil with a indigenous, mestizo religion called Santo Daime, where the voice of Quetzalcoatl announced itself and spoke in my head for a few days. That was like a main part of the book. So, you know, that was not something that I really believed could happen or had any frame of reference for. So, you know, whatever the actual kind of truth content of that experience, it was a realization that when these ancient prophets like Moses or Muhammad talk about, you know, the voice of God speaking to their head, it's like a very real, subjectively, you know, phenomenologically, very real and powerful experience.
You have done a great deal of exploration with ayahuasca. Graham Hancock has been on our program a number of times, and he talks about the profound experiences he had with it. In fact, he considers it a creative muse in a way after an episode. How do you classify your experience with ayahuasca? Would you say it enhances your cognition, or would you say that it is just something to get out of a reality on a short kind of a trip?
No, I mean, I think, you know, it's not like a universal like panacea or whatever. It's a tool. You know, it does seem to me that there's like a being attached to it, like a feminine spiritual essence that teaches and communicates. But it's also a gateway. So when you take ayahuasca, you can have a huge range of different experiences. You can visit different, you know, realms of what seems to be like other dimensions, the astral plane. You can visit spirits of the dead. You can, you know, have all sorts of, you know, feel like you're visiting other realities. You know, the Sequoia, who I worked with in the Amazon in Ecuador, said that for them, the purpose of ayahuasca was to visit the what they called the heavenly people, which was kind of like their, you know, kind of kin in the spirit world, who they would sing these songs and the spirit people would come, and it kind of confirmed a whole understanding they had of the nature of existence and reality.
Does it help to set an intention before you go on an ayahuasca, do an ayahuasca ceremony? I mean, you have guides with you that are watching how you react during the actual experience, but does it make a difference if you say, I am looking for this kind of a answer to this question? Or how do you use it?
Sometimes it makes a difference. Sometimes they totally disregard you, or whatever, you know, so, you know, sometimes it just goes on its own way. So, you know, it has its own, it seems to have its own intelligence. So, but, you know, I mean, a lot of people take ayahuasca because they want to heal something physically or psychologically. And, you know, sometimes it seems to them that they have particular answers, you know, that come through into.
You know, the big thing that's happening right now is these, they're calling brain hackers, and they're doing microdosing of LSD, ayahuasca, and these other psychotropic drugs. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm here in California, and in San Jose, there's people that are in high tech that are using it for creativity, for motivation, and so forth. Do you think that is something that is likely to take hold of a larger population?
Yeah, I think it probably will, particularly the microdosing, because it's not so terrifying for people. And, you know, what we have over the last decade, since I wrote Breaking Open the Head, which came out in 2002, is a lot of, you know, more amazing evidence around the value of psychedelics. So, for instance, the Imperial College in London has been doing brain scans of people on psilocybin and LSD. And you can actually see that different parts of the brain, which are normally dormant, kind of light up like Christmas trees, and new pathways of connection between different areas of the brain suddenly form. So all of that would go strongly with the anecdotal evidence that psychedelics are great for, you know, creative thinking, seeing, you know, new connections between things, you know, which almost could be the definition of creative thinking, right? See, making new connections. And yes, there's a huge amount of, you know, anecdotal evidence that supports the value of psychedelics for creative thinking. I mean, you know, anecdotally, it's thought that Francis Crick was taking, you know, LSD, I think, or when he just, you know, when they discovered the double helix shape of the DNA, mm-hmm. You know, Steve Jobs said it was the most important experience of his life. I mean, Carrie Mullis won the Nobel Prize for polymer chain reactions, you know, used mushrooms, I think, to model the movements of different molecules and so on. So yeah, I mean, evidence seems pretty strong anecdotally that it, you know, leads to creative breakthroughs. And now we also have collaboration actually looking at the brain scans of people.
Hmm. There are some pseudoscientists that believe that the Maya took psychedelics, you know, as a regular form of communing with the higher spirits. And this is the reason that they advanced their culture to such a high degree. I don't know quite how to, because we don't have evidence of it. There's no codices that are written. There's no evidence that we have. I don't think we found any bowls with crushed mushrooms or any other psychedelics. But what do you say about that belief that this is a way towards their evolution?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of evidence actually that different Mesoamerican civilizations were using psychedelics as sacraments. I mean, murals, sculptures, and so on. Yeah, I mean, if you go to a place like Palenque, you know, it's, or Chichen Itza, I mean, it's clear the whole thing is a ritual center. You know, it seems like it was part of the spiritual or esoteric practices of those cultures, you know, the same way that, you know, meditation and dark retreats are part of the esoteric spiritual practices of Tibetan Buddhist culture.
Mm-hmm. But would you say that if we bring them forward in today's society, that to evolve, we should consider using psychedelics, and so we can actually see what the future looks like, to get a sense from the other dimensions, so to speak, that influence us in whatever manner they do influence us. Should we be using them more regularly?
Yeah, I mean that's already happening, frankly. I mean, the boat's already left the dock. I mean, many, many people are using them more, and there's a huge psychedelic renaissance happening around the world, and, you know, these things are becoming quite, you know, like when I wrote Breaking Up With Head, I would travel around and talk about the book, and nobody had heard of ayahuasca. Now, if I go into a room, you know, in some place, and I say, who knows about ayahuasca? Well, every hand goes up. How many people have taken it? You know, a third of the hands go up. So, you know, but these things are not necessarily for everybody. They certainly weren't in indigenous societies. You know, there are some people who, you know, have more of a dispensation to be shamans or to visit the other worlds. It tends to be a smaller percentage of people in every society. But yeah, so I think, you know, part of what we've been going through since the 50s is kind of a reintegration process of these entheogenic plants into modern society. And it's had a number of different stages, but now that integration, you know, seems to be well underway. We're seeing decriminalization of psychedelics in places like Oakland and Portland. We're seeing the corporatization of psychedelics, a big rush by big companies, new companies to, you know, kind of enter the psychedelic space and establish territory there. And then we're seeing the growth of shamanic practices around the world. So yeah, it's a huge psychedelic renaissance that's happening globally.
Would you say the environmental death is also a influence on plant medicine coming to the forefront? I mean, you could call it a Gaia consciousness. Is like, either you help us or you die with us.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, it definitely feels that all these things are, that they're all clearly happening at the same time. And maybe there's some purpose to it, but of course, you know, you have to be a little careful because, you know, sometimes you know, we get very excited about something. It doesn't happen the way we think. I mean, you know, that was why, like, in, back in the 60s, you know, Timothy Leary was pushing for LSD, you know, even though he'd really only done psychedelics for a few years himself. But that was the time of atomic, you know, the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there was this sudden dawning realization that, you know, we needed to do something or we would, you know, maybe end up destroying ourselves with atomic weapons. So the psychedelic movement at that time believed that we needed a mass awakening to avert a sort of atomic holocaust. And yeah, I could say at this time, you know, we are facing, you know, ecological Armageddon. And yeah, it could be possible that entheogenic experience can reconnect people to nature and reposition them in terms of how they use their creativity and resources in relationship to the planetary emergency that's underway.
Hmm. One of the things in your book I found was fascinating is you talked about alien abductions. And I'm curious about your point of view when we look at the Pentagon, who has now recategorized UFOs as UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, but they still do not want to identify the beings who are flying the craft, who are obviously alien beings. I mean, what do you say about that in terms of a disclosure? Because it is a disclosure, but it's on a very linear level, I think.
Well, I mean, something I've written about a lot. I mean, I wrote about the crop circles and, as you said, alien abductions, UFOs in 2012, the Truth Council Quantum. I actually have a short book on Amazon called The Occult Control System, where I also look at, you know, more recently, the disclosure stuff around UFOs and ETs and so on. I'm partial to some of Jacques Vallée's ideas that somehow the way the thing always like hovers on the periphery and how we constantly think we're going to get this massive disclosure or this contact and it doesn't happen. He thinks it's kind of like a consciousness control system, that there are these kind of, you know, beings in these higher dimensions, but they seem to be subverting, you know, our desire for, you know, certainty, our desire for contact. Almost like an orchestrated tease in a way.
You don't feel it's the military is the, as I, what was his name? I'm just trying to think of the president who talked about the military industrial complex.
Eisenhower.
Thank you. Taking over and basically saying, watch out, this is going to get so big that it's going to run your life. And from every indication from Bob Lazar on, it looks like not only are we reverse engineering whatever these down craft are, but who knows who's in the sky? Is it terrestrial craft or is it extraterrestrial craft? So, you know, and here we are, the Pentagon looking at footage from an F-18 of a unidentified flying object and saying, well, we're going to study this. And by the way, here's a press release, but not saying or identifying who is flying these crafts and what's the technology behind them. You know, it's really strange. I mean,
there's all sorts of possibilities. I mean, there might be a cover up. I mean, I had a friend who was working as a producer on one of the recent series on UFOs and ETs, and he started out as kind of a skeptic, but the more that he, you know, spoke to people involved, he realized there was kind of like fragmentary knowledge in these different secret groups, secret intelligence groups. Some of them were for disclosure, some of them were against it. The Bob Lazar stuff is interesting because it seems pretty evident that he was reverse engineering these alien crafts that use some kind of anti-gravity propulsion fueled by uranium-15 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean it's very interesting, but it's a tough one. I mean, the crop circles are really intriguing to me because they really do seem like a benevolent communication over decades, where they're really trying to give us a gentle cueing in to kind of like the underlying nature of the universe. It's like fractal and holographic qualities, and the importance of sacred geometry, the knowledge of ancient and Neolithic cultures, you know, about the integration of the sun and moon cycles around ley lines and so on. It's almost like they're giving us a lesson on how to kind of upgrade and connect, you know, the modern scientific worldview with these more like ancient and indigenous ways of knowing.
Hmm. What do you think happens to Earth human when there is a revelation that we're not the only one in the universe. And this can be either sacred documents are found or codices, or I would love to see somebody come down from another nearby planet and say, hey, guys, you're part of a collective. Some people, I mean, there's this Browning Institute report that was written in the 1960s that says the churches will go nuts, people will kill themselves, so forth and so on. And the rumor is that the military is still adhering to that document. But what's your feeling on that?
Well, it's, I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't think for a lot of people it would be that surprising, actually. I mean, it also would really depend on what form the contact was to take. I mean, you know, I mean, for instance, actually, I love like Terrence McKenna's idea that even like the psilocybin mushrooms may actually be like a higher form of galactic intelligence that distributes itself across the universe on spores. You know, I mean, you know, what we call extraterrestrial may take forms that are quite different than we understand or we've thought. You know, so yeah, will the contact be benevolent? I mean, I think it was like, you know, some type of neighboring, you know, alien that was just like, hey, we're here, you know, Mazel Tov. I mean, you know, I don't think people would be that freaked out at this point, you know. I mean, the implication, you know, as I discussed in the Occult Control System in the 2012 book, is that there's kind of a malevolent level of alien intelligence, which may not be extraterrestrial so much as like interdimensional, who go by the name of, you know, we know them as the gray aliens. They've sort of infiltrated pop culture, but they seem to have some kind of like plan underway to kind of take control of the planet with hybrid human aliens, you know, at a point of ecological disaster. Books like The Threat by David Jacobs have kind of teased out that narrative, you know, but is that something that happens literally in this reality, or is it something that happens on a different, you know, dimensional timeline or something? I can't tell you.
In McKenna's True Hallucinogens, he actually talks about seeing aliens and interacting with off-world types, what he identified as off-world types. I don't remember exactly what they said to him, but he just felt that they were not from from Earth. Have you had that experience with beings from off-world types, or not necessarily off-world, but who seem very non-human, hominin type?
Well, as I said, with McKenna, it was largely the mushroom intelligence. Then he had some experience with the flying saucers. And he felt this mushroom intelligence was a very ancient, you know, very advanced form of consciousness that had a source, you know, somewhere else in the universe. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like I've had, you know, kind of like different subtle experiences, but it's not something I would necessarily, you know, blurt out and be like, you know, I know this because I had this experience. You know?
I hear you. Yeah. plant medicines are growing on a number of different levels. I mean, I write about cannabis as something that is growing in popularity. It has been popular for a long time. But when we talk about people like Elon Musk, he seems to rather have us do his Neuralink program, where we have chips embedded in the cranium as a form of evolution. What do you see the future as? Do you see Elon Musk's brain enhancement as a positive, or would you say that we evolve more naturally using plant medicines?
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, for a long time, I'm interested in the whole concept of the singularity from Ray Kurzweil. You know, there's a Singularity University in California. This is the idea that the sort of, you know, evolutionary destiny of humanity is to kind of become immortal by merging with our, you know, silicon-based technologies. you know, and also those technologies are going to evolve. So we have like nanobots and so on that can actually like heal us, like, you know, breathe for us, you know, perform circulation functions for us. That's all the stuff that Kurzweil lays out in The Singularity Is Near. I've had mixed feelings about that. I mean, actually right now for my Liminal Institute, I'm teaching a seminar on looking at kind of evidence for consciousness after death and kind of afterlife realms, other dimensions where souls may end up, you know. And I think there's a lot of very interesting evidence that suggests, you know, this is not the end. And I think if we were to begin to understand, integrate that understanding and step beyond the scientific materialist paradigm, we might become a little bit less focused on, you know, kind of the singularity as a physical or mechanical evolutionary jump. And we might realize that we're already, you know, connected to, you know, these hyper dimensions and we'll learn to know more about them through our psychic and spiritual evolution over successive incarnations.
Hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I think we really do need an expanded frame of reference at this point.
Who are the new shaman today, modern day shaman? I mean, obviously they people who write about it, people who are suggesting psychedelics. I mean, I can name you as one of the people who are kind of moving the chain forward, but I mean, it's hard to see our evolution because we can't see into the future. But based on what is happening right now, on many levels, we're in some serious trouble, not just environmentally. I think on social political sides, we're problematic too. Can you speak to the current political environment in the United States, where we have the Democrats versus the conservatives, the Republicans, and the disparities? And what I'm seeing is such a huge gap between the ability to be have a progressive agenda versus a regressive agenda. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, you know, it's everything is changing, you know, pretty rapidly. And sometimes our old terminologies like right, left or whatever, you know, are getting sort of outmoded and obsolete in certain ways. Like it's hard to really totally fathom what's happening. I mean, it sort of seems like, I mean, I wrote a couple of recent pieces about it, like this idea of technocracy, you know, that our technology is evolving so rapidly, and it's sort of integrating with financial systems and governments and biotechnology companies, pharmaceutical companies. So that's all becoming sort of a singular force that has kind of a power of censorship, you know, control over borders, you know, power over life and death in a way. So, you know, you could kind of argue that we're moving towards this kind of inexorably moving. It's not even necessarily the will of any single individual, you know, although some people obviously are more involved in it than not, to a kind of technocratic control paradigm that's going to be very hard to escape. And of course, we see that happening in China with the social credit system. And people, if they're, you know, not seen as, you know, towing the party line, you know, their children can't go to school, they can't travel and so on. So they can, you know, so the danger is that the West will also see some version of the social credit system, but and it could come through subtler means. It could come through, I mean, one big concern would be, you know, centralized digital currencies that are make every transaction completely trackable. So if a central bank doesn't like what you're doing, what you're talking about, you know, beyond censorship, they could just shut off your money the way they shut off like a, you know, water in a faucet or something. So so there's a lot of things to be concerned about. I mean, on the flip side, you know, I'm also in the 2012 book, I looked a lot at the ideas of thinkers like Teilhard de Chardin, who was a Catholic mystic and paleontologist, who had an idea of something called the nuosphere. So he thought there was an evolution, and Jose Arguelles and other people picked up on this idea. There was kind of an evolution that was happening from the earlier kind of biological stage, organic stage of evolution, which they call the biosphere. And then humanity emerged and we had self-aware intelligence and language and tool using capacity. And we've over the last, you know, 20 centuries or whatever it is, 50 centuries, created something called the technosphere, where we've kind of you know, paved over the biosphere. We've created this artificial new reality of like roads, highways, trade routes, satellites, and so on. But the noosphere is the technosphere is potentially just a bridging mechanism to bring us to another state of human evolution and development, which Teilhard de Chardin called the noosphere, from the Greek word nous, meaning mind. So that would be humanity kind of coming together as a collective organism, a collective thinking organism that could direct its own evolutionary capacity. So in a way, it could be that what seems like these negative control systems, like technocracy and surveillance, while they are kind of horrible in the interim, mm-hmm. could be pointing towards a kind of mutational change where humanity does kind of integrate as one vast thinking organism.
Mm. How do you see the role of COVID playing itself out? It seems like there's new versions of this virus that keep mutating. And with we don't have 100% buy-in simply because part of the world was the COVID was politicized. And then there's a whole other part, and you can see this in different countries, of people who just didn't feel they wanted to get the jab for whatever reason. And you could throw a whole bunch of science at them and the history of inoculations and so forth and so on. And there's still huge resistance. These variants now are popping up with frightening speed. What do you say about that?
God, Cliff, like any one of these questions could be like an hour and a half answer. I mean, I think there are so many points to that. I also wrote I have a Substack newsletter, which people can look up. And I wrote an article there recently called From Vacillation to Vaccination.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Last year, and I really didn't want to get the vaccine. But moving back to New York City and, you know, seeing my family and wanting to see my mother, and then also realizing, you know, that the Delta variant was, you know, extremely scary in some ways, you know, I did finally get the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. But I can understand both sides of the story. You know, so, yeah, particularly when it comes to the mRNA vaccines, you know, these are, you know, relatively new technologies that don't have a long history of human use. And there are concerns that have even come from Nobel Prize winning virologists like Luc Montagnier, who won a Nobel Prize for his work on HIV, and Geert Vanderbosch used to run, was a project director at Gavi, Bill Gates's vaccine foundation. And they have legitimate concerns that this mass vaccination is a human health, a global health catastrophe in the making, that the vaccines themselves are going to cause the variants. And that also the vaccines may turn out to have, health consequences over time. So what we've seen with like blood clots and fertility issues, you know, that might not be random. It might be a sign of things to come. And then, of course, if you look at the, you know, pharmaceutical companies, they don't always have a great track record. Like Merck, I think, created Vioxx, which they knew was going to cause heart attacks, but they realized they would still make money on it. So like 500,000 people may have died from Vioxx in the U.S., you know, there was thalidomide and so on. And we know in general, publicly traded companies don't always work in society's best interest, you know, whether it's fossil fuel companies or tobacco companies or, you know, mainstream media companies. So, you know, we're suddenly giving, you know, I can understand people's fear of a situation where you're giving, you know, publicly traded companies in alignment, you know, in allegiance with governments, you know, access to everybody's immune system. You know, there's also, you know, a tendency over time with capitalism that things that were once just, you know, things that people took care of for themselves become kind of outsourced to corporations because capitalism constantly needs new markets. You know, so, you know, we used to just drink fresh water from a stream. You know, now, you know, even most of our water is a little bit tainted. So we have to drink bottled water from Fiji or Evian or whatever if we can afford it. You know, we used to just, you know, entertain our own kids. You know, now we have television or, you know, Game Boys. You know, we used to educate our own kids, but now we have like daycare and school. So, you know, everything gets outsourced to capitalism because it always needs new markets. It's very unstable.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
Now we're running out of markets. Well, what's another market? Like our own immune system. You know, so I guess the fear that people feel, which I also feel concerned about, is that with this ongoing, you know, vaccines and variants, are we actually being forced to like outsource our, you know, immune system functions to these corporations, you know, where we have to get a booster every 3 months and, you know, some people actually just question the evidence around the whole thing and so on. So I do think that it's murky. I mean, I ended up, you know, doing the Johnson & Johnson, which is not one of the mRNA vaccines, because I do live in a very dense city called, you know, New York. And I did begin to get worried about the, you know, the danger of the Delta vaccine, the variant and so on. So I think it was the right decision for me. And I want to see my mother and not be guilty, worried, you know, but, you know, we're also seeing that the vaccines are diminishing in power over several months, and that people are getting, you know, more and more serious cases of the virus, even when they're vaccinated. So it's all become a very murky area.
Yeah. Yeah. It's has a lot of questions and not always positive what the future holds on that.
And then on the other hand, you know, in the past, when there were major epidemics, you know, I think people were just forced to get mass vaccinated for like smallpox or something. Like this idea of individual sovereignty, which has now become such a cherished ideal, you know, maybe people in the 1930s or 1920s didn't even, you know, think about it in those terms, you know? So yeah, it's like a lot of complex issues to think about.
Wow. I'm curious about your feeling on what many archaeologists believe was the Maya's degeneration, or how they de-evolved. Do you think that we are in this kind of the same spin as the Maya, where they were at a high level for thousands of years and then slowly through whatever means? I mean, Hancock talks about the mass asteroid hit that caused a worldwide flood and began to, I think his belief is that the asteroid hit was so devastating to the planet that 80% of the human life was immediately destroyed. But what do you say about our current environment and our current standing as a civilization? And does it parallel the Maya?
No, I've never really felt that it parallels the Maya. I mean, I mean, some archaeologists like Jared Diamond argued in Collapse that the Maya kind of overdeveloped and then had an agricultural, they had a drought and agriculture collapsed. But I really don't know if the evidence is that great. Also, the Maya were spread over like a huge area, and there was a lot of jungles and so on. I mean, my theory about it actually is that, this idea that a civilization is meant to continue forever is an idea that we have in modern society. Like, if you ask somebody, when is the United States of America going to end? They'll look at you like you're crazy. But, you know, we can see that actually there's a natural life cycle to cultures and civilizations. And, you know, the Maya, who were extremely focused on cycles of time and these 260-year Bakhtin cycles, they may never have had the thought that they were going to be around in that you know, highly developed form forever. They may have really understood that, you know, they were going to be there for a few Bakhtin cycles, and then they would go back to living in a more indigenous way and leave those monuments to rediscover it by future generation. You know, we really don't know, but I think it's not a good idea to kind of take what's happening with us and impose it on a culture that, you know, is so different. In terms of our situation, yeah, we're literally in danger of bringing about extinction of ourselves, and civilizational collapse is highly probable at this point. We're looking at 125 degree spikes, days where the temperature spikes. And, you know, how long can agriculture sustain itself, you know, when you have this much unpredictability, you know, when you have these mega droughts, we have more and more environmental refugees around the world. I think it's like 60 million people are now environmental refugees. I don't know. So we've already seen narrow escapes for huge cities like Cape Town or Rio, you know, almost run out of water. And it's like down, you know, so I think in the next 10 or 20 years, we're going to see, massive difficulties around the ecological emergency, but hopefully that will catalyze this mass awakening. And for instance, from my perspective, as I just wrote in a little essay today, you know, we can't continue capitalism as it is. I mean, it was, you know, it got us to this point. We globalized, we developed technologies and so on, but you know, it's a very unstable system that forces companies themselves to keep extracting and exploiting resources and creating new markets and you know, basically acting like sort of bad, you know, humans in a way on a large scale. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we actually at a dime, we're going to need to develop a new, you know, sort of infrastructure for humanity to exchange value and have different values. Like, well, you know, it's like, you know, do we really need people, you know, shooting all around the world as tourists, whenever they want, you know, thousands and thousands of people going to, you know, all around the world? Is that the best model, or should we really be allowing, you know, kind of local communities to, you know, become stronger and focus on, you know, regenerative practices within local communities? And could we restructure our whole, you know, global economic system to be focused on the ecological health of localities?
Hmm. So you're saying rather than the United States being the big brother helping everybody else, we should stay home and maybe look at local communities and developing them so that they are self-sustaining?
Well, I wasn't really pointing at the United States. I'm saying, you know, globally, you know, what we're going to need is kind of a relocalization movement. And, you know, we're going to need, it's sort of beyond like what we now know. I mean, this is all covered in my 2016 book, How Soon Is Now, which has actually introductions by Russell Brand and Sting. And my effort to kind of look at the ecological emergency and provide like a template for the types of changes we would have to make.
Hmm. You brought up something interesting, and I'm just curious about your thought. There's been a couple of different books and multiple articles that compare the United States to Rome. Rome had senators. They had a pretty tough, during its heyday, political system, but it imploded on itself. Do you see or portell bits and pieces of that here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, that's one corollary you could look at. I mean, also, in a way, you know, America, as the inheritor of the European colonialism and imperialism project, was also the inheritor of ancient Rome and its, you know, interest. I mean, you know, basically what's happening on the world stage right now is kind of the rise of China, China becoming the most powerful culture, and kind of the diminishment of the West in terms of its influence and power. And, you know, that's bittersweet and problematic. But, you know, the West still, I think, could be at the forefront of kind of a new humanist revolution, you know, and even a new spiritual or sort of mystical revolution, you know, once we understand the value of inner experience, you know, the way we need to.
How do we get the value of inner experience out to the corporations who can't even see beyond the dollar bill, though? That's the whole thing that I am trying to figure out on my own. I mean, I've been meditating for 30 years, and without meditation, I'd be screwed. But how you get that to that level to a corporation and begin telling people and showing it through advertising rather than pharmacological advertising? What about meditations as advertising? I mean, that would be the way to do it, because once you tell people to close or show them how to relax their brain and do a meditation, then everything kind of changes. They can settle down and see things a little differently.
Yeah, but I mean, that's totally been happening. I mean, there's a huge mindfulness movement, and, you know, with corporations, you know, maybe more the, you know, more like tech companies, like, you know, Google and so on. But yeah, a lot of companies have introduced mindfulness, and as you mentioned earlier, some of them are even looking at microdosing psychedelics as a way to increase productivity. I mean, corporations, of course, are mainly interested in productivity. So if something like mindfulness helps reduce kind of problems in the office and leads to better, you know, outcomes and so on, of course they'll go in that direction. But, you know, of course, by itself, that doesn't also solve these other like social and ecological issues that we're facing.
Hmm. All right. Hey, what are you up to right now? You're writing a new book. Tell us about what kind of work you're doing.
So at the moment, I'm running an online seminar at theliminalinstitute.com, www.theliminalinstitute.com, which is called Crossing the Threshold, Realms of Consciousness Beyond Physical Death. And we're looking at all of the evidence for the existence of some form of essence or individuality after death, including near-death experience, mediumship, children who spontaneously recall their past lives. And then we're looking at the theories around it, how kind of interpretations of quantum physics would allow for there to be a kind of essence of the individual that can consist in some form after death and seek reincarnation. Then we're also looking at the works of people like Frederick Myers, who was one of the founders of the Society for Psychic Research in the 19th century, who wrote a book called The Survival of the Human Personality After Bodily Death, like this huge magnum opus on the topic. And also people like Rudolf Steiner, who was an Austrian visionary, who actually said the mission of his life on Earth was to bring the knowledge of reincarnation back to the West, and really wrote about it in incredible depth and complexity.
Wow. Tell people how they can get to your newsletter, because that's where you want people to go now when they to read your article.
Yeah, for sure. That's on substack.com. So I don't have the exact link on me, but I think if they just, you know, Googled my name, Pinchbeck,
okay,
Substack, it would pop right up.
Excellent. Hey, Daniel, thanks for your time. It was nice to hear what you're up to and get a kind of a look at where we're going and your personal experiences, which are kind of cool too. You kind of explained to everybody in your work what you're seeing and maybe how it affects the others. Can you give us a hint in the next 5 years as a kind of a closing question, 5 or 10 years? You have talked a little bit about technocrats and so forth and so on, but I mean, does America survive the next 5 or 10 years, or is this going to be kind of the beginning of the end? I'm not feeling really positive about the United States right now, obviously.
I don't really feel that I'm somebody who can make predictions like that. I mean, you know, I'm intrigued by the growing interest in, you know, consciousness and ecology and psychedelics, you know, in this time of, you know, breakdown and disruption. So I think we'll sort of continue to see the tension between those developments. And we'll also see, kind of this technocratic system kind of emerging as something that's almost like post-governmental. And it's emerging at places like World Economic Forum and so on. But it's not necessarily good news. It's a subtler but quite invasive form of control. And, you know, we're certainly being controlled all the time with algorithms and, you know, on more and more subtle levels. So, I think it's a great time for people to seek out their own sovereignty, learn how to take care of their communities, to start, you know, producing some of their own food and energy and so on. And to educate themselves about all the things that the mainstream media, you know, won't even discuss, or doesn't discuss in the right way. You know, if it does discuss, so yeah, they might find my books like How Soon Is Now, Breaking Open the Head, On Plant Stream in 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, you know, which also most of them have like huge bibliographies. So it's a way to open up into a whole different way of thinking and a line of thinking. They might find those very helpful.
Cool. All right. Hey, man, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for chatting.
All his books, Daniel Pinchbeck's books, are fascinating to read. Some of them are dark. Some of them, like the 2012 book, has chapters where he's actually writing about his ayahuasca trip and who he's meeting with. And that is, I love that for many reasons, simply because it's a challenge to go through, in some cases, the trauma of an ayahuasca vision and come out on the other side and be able to write about it. Now, we know Terry McKenna was able to write about it. Some other people have written about it. Graham Hancock writes extensively about his ayahuasca experiences, and more power to him. I appreciate that. I'm interested in the actual language of these beings that are presenting data. And Terry McKenna talks about these off-world types that he encountered. Later in the year, I think it's going to be November, we're going to be talking to two psychologists who have documented people's experience on psychedelic drugs, most notably DMT. And what some of those people talk about is simply amazing. In some cases, you might even see the prophetic. There's bits and pieces of prophecy in what they're saying. That sounds really weird, but you know, we don't know enough about the brain. We don't know how the mind works, and when these people are taking these very, very powerful drugs that affect the central nervous system in the brain, we don't know what dimensions are opening up. We don't know who they're connecting with. We don't know enough about our own reality to be able to judge and criticize people who are writing about their journeys under the influence. Well, you know, a lot of the medical community says, well, they're just hallucinating. Or a psychiatrist will say, well, that's the drug talking. That's not any levels of consciousness, reality, whatever. Well, here we go again. If your training, and I talk about this about anthropologists and archaeologists, if your training only allows a certain amount of data and you're taught not to accept other data, then you're not going to even consider somebody bending time, bending reality, passing through dimensional portals, whatever, and considering what they are reporting as a valid experience. I throw up my hands when I read about someone criticizing an experience somebody's had under the influence of a psychotropic drug. So, you know, it's not for everybody. Not everybody. I won't do acid. I won't do LSD ever. I won't do it. Part of me wants to do ayahuasca. But, you know, if you read about the experience of ayahuasca, it's not very fun. It's more like a cathartic, gut-wrenching experience. And we've heard it from past interviewers or guests who have been through it. And I don't know. That's not something I'm that interested in doing. But, hey, more power to those who do get involved and do use drugs to enhance their reality. Hey, and the other thing is, and I don't think it's ayahuasca that'll be microdose, but microdosing for depression, for creativity, this is some of the wave of the future. Now, it's not approved by the FDA. A lot of people follow the FDA, but a lot of people are using drugs in microdose. Are using microdoses of various drugs to turn their brain on, to access different realities, and to experience other dimensions. And hey, if it makes you feel better, if it improves your life, if it makes you more creative, why not? I don't have a problem with that. So, Daniel Pinchback, check out that book. Oh, by the way, if you are a member of Patreon, if you're a subscriber, that book is available as a free download. 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl is a download. You can see it there. Among lots of other books that are available there, so check it out. Hey, we are going to Egypt May 3rd through the 15th, 2022. I'm talking about it because a lot of people are getting up and thinking about planning their vacation. Right now is the time to start planning. This is May 2022. This is an all-inclusive VIP, what I call a diplomatic tour, simply because we are given private access to these sites, private visits to many of the great sites that we find in Egypt, private boat, private bus, armed guard. It is like you are a member of a foreign company, country coming to visit. So for more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. Click on the banner for Egypt and register. Read the itinerary and then register, because it is an amazing tour. Hey, and by the way, we're making it accessible to anyone who is a listener, our audience here, Earth Ancients or Destiny. You're going to get almost 40% discount off the top of the price. So something to consider. 40% is a really good incentive for a lot of people. So if you're interested in Egypt, it is an amazing tour. Check it out, earthancients.com/tours. All right, that's it for this program. I want to thank my guest today, Daniel Pinchbeck, discussing his book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. As always, our team, Bruce Fenton in London, Ruth Thomas in British Columbia. You guys rock. By the way, everyone, we are the recipients of the People's Choice Award as one of the best culture and history podcasts of 2021. And I'll talk more about that. I just got the information. Without this dedicated group of people, we would not have gotten that award. So thank you all who voted for us as your favorite podcast. All right, that's it for today. Take care, be well, and we'll talk to you soon.